Welcome to February's episode of AZMcast. All board review, all the time. Sorry, I can't do the deep voice. Welcome to February's Arizona MCast. It's the board review episode. We do this every year right before the in-training exam to try to help our residents pick up a couple extra points. We cover some pearls on things that you may or may not see on your exam. And this month we've got Brian Drummond joining Jared and I to discuss some interesting things that you guys may need to remember and keep in mind for your in-training exam. This can often be one of the most boring episodes of the year. However, we make sure to spice it up a little bit with Brian, with Jared, with me, and also with the wonderful addition of our own Nate Holman reading cheesy medical pickup lines. So sit back, relax, switch your brains on to memorize, and try not to have strange feelings about Nate Holman.
It's business time. It's business time. It's business.
Blood is red, cyanosis is blue. I get diaphoretic when I think of you.
We had someone hit with a shake weight yesterday. Gunshot wound in the penis and a shake weight.
It was a good day.
The gunshot wound was 7 days old. Self-treated with meth and heroin. I thought we should write it up.
Well, everybody, we have a special treat this month. I don't know if it's special. It's special for us because we got our cool new soundstage, which is basically my office with a bunch of blankets and some of my closest friends.
It kind of looks like what I imagine 50 Shades of Grey looks like.
It's blue. It's actually mostly blue. So Brian and Jared and I have all gotten together to do board review this month. Instead of doing cases, instead of doing other things, we want to get everybody prepared for boards, which is also why this is coming out early.
And we flipped the script on Drummond. He's on this side of the podcast this
month.
Yeah,
so there.
I'm going to review myself.
I'm just going to dress yourself down. That was stupid, Drummond.
That was a stupid comment.
Yes, it was.
Do you really feed your DKA patients?
Always.
That's interesting.
Interesting.
Until
nice
they vomit. Foolish.
So we have a new setup, which for better or for worse, I don't know, we'll see. Hopefully it'll be nicer, you can hear us a bit better, it won't be as echoey. So we're going to go through a few things that, in looking at last year's ITE scores, were some of the outliers, some of the things that stood out. Honestly, our residents do fantastic. You guys do great at the ITEs. We have a fantastic board, written and oral board pass rate. We're not worried about you guys. We want to give you that little extra confidence boost. We scraped the bottom of the bottom three things that showed up as far as what our residents had any trouble with compared to other residents, and those three things were OB-GYN, environmental, and some heme stuff. So we were just kind of spitball a bit about some of the things in each of those categories that may come up. These are high yield topics, things that people love to ask about, because even though they might be rare, they show up on the boards quite a bit. So Jared's got our Tint and Alley's Just the Facts open right now. What are you reading, man?
I'm reading about ectopic pregnancy.
Oh, okay. So let's talk first about vaginal bleeding, one of my least favorite topics. Patient comes in with vaginal bleeding. The things you're going to want to differentiate first is stable or unstable. Don't get fooled by, oh, let's send them off to ultrasound. That's a real, that's an easy one for them to fool you. Instead, you should always go for airway breathing circulation or circulation airway breathing. Always maintain your IV, get your monitor, get everything stabilized before you send the patient out of the department anytime. And then the next step for me is going to be pregnant or not pregnant. What have you guys found when you've kind of done these questions with people as far as the imaging for vaginal bleeding?
I think the first imaging will be ultrasound. They'll ask you ultrasound, yes or no, point of care. They'll probably show you some pictures, gestational sac, yolk sac, fluid in the pelvis, no fluid in the pelvis, maybe a mass adnexally. Those will be the big things that they'll show you picture-wise. They may tell you there's a something in the adnex, or they may say that there's fluid in the pelvis and you have a positive pregnancy test with vaginal bleeding. If a pregnancy test is negative and vaginal bleeding, they're probably looking at something else. Or a long-term, those are usually long-term vaginal bleeding, maybe 2 to 4 weeks of vaginal bleeding. What else do you need to think about?
The other thing you'll see is they'll give you a beta quant of 1500 or 2500 and ask what you should be able to see at that stage.
So some of the pictures you may actually have to identify, they're certainly going to expect that you can identify a positive FAST. So if you get a pregnant vaginal bleed and they show you a picture of a Morrison's pouch, you better be able to figure out what that one is, because that's going to be way more useful than even your transvaginal ultrasound to try to find the heartbeat. So that's one of the nice things with the pictures, is they can't yet do videos, so you won't have a whole lot, but you should be able to identify some of these things, like, wow, that's a giant cyst. Wow, that's a double decidual sign, or some of these other things that our ultrasound people have equipped you very well to know. The second thing is, when you think of vaginal bleeding, think of your workup. If you're pregnant, always remember Rogam. Always remember your type and screen for anybody, type and screen or type and cross for anybody that's bleeding profusely, so that you can give blood. Always think of, what is this question trying to get at? The people that write these questions, they're trying to make sure you know a useful fact in emergency medicine, not just some random thing of, I hope you can know what I'm thinking. Think about, what is this question asking? What are they trying to assess that I know? And with vaginal bleeding, it's usually an issue of, can you remember your ABCs first? Can you identify some of the signs of an ectopic pregnancy? And can you remember the important labs to get for further follow-up?
Some of the rarest stuff they'll ask is, you know, a typical question for the ruptured ectopic is the, you know, late teens, early 20s patient who comes in with, you know, right or left lower quadrant abdominal pain and is hypotensive and flush, and they'll give you a picture of a positive FAST exam. But they may also say late 20s, early 30s, female, on IVF, who comes in with lower quadrant pain, vaginal bleeding, and they'll give you a positive FAST exam. And that's ascites, and they have pleural effusions and whatnot. That's ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome. That's a completely different treatment than rush off to the OR.
I would miss that one.
Yeah.
Brian, would you miss that one?
No, Brian would get it. I'd probably, a couple years ago, I'd get it, but... I haven't thought about it in a while. I think the treatment's like metformin or something, too, or they do something.
It's just
that.
Supportive care.
Just supportive care. Yeah. What? Oh, polycystic ovarian syndrome. Yeah. That's the metformin.
You can never go wrong with supportive care.
Yeah, supportive care. What they like on these questions, too, is they'll ask, what is the next most appropriate step? Mm-hmm. And that's where Aaron's talking about. You go through your ABCs. Or does the patient need an OBGYN consult? Can they see them tomorrow? Or do they need to go to the OR? And that's where you're making that decision based on what they've given you with the FAST and vital signs, where that patient needs to go. They always like next appropriate step. That's a common.
Yeah, or they'll ask two things down the line, like the ruptured ectopic. They won't ask you what it is or what the next thing to do is. They'll ask you which blood product to give. You know, do you want O positive, O negative?
Yeah, they'll expect that you can diagnose. They'll expect that you know some of the tests, and then they'll ask you even one step further. So, which is really rough if you don't have any idea of what the scenario is, which I've been in that place several times during the tests, and I put a big circle around. I'm coming back to that one after I pick up some loose change on some of these easy ones, like, oh, do CPR on the patient without pulse, or in PEA. So don't be thrown off by anything like that. Make sure that you just read through the question. You guys know how to take care of people, and try to pick up some of these easier ones.
And the questions are 5 years behind, right? They're not going to ask you, if a cardiac arrest patient comes in, what temperature you should target. They're not going to ask you that.
They're not going to ask you about ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome.
No,
they might.
Won't be.
They might.
No, they
might.
Not.
They could.
That's
they
the boards for critical care.
So moving on from vaginal bleeding, so pelvic pain. There's a couple things you will certainly have to pick out with pelvic pain. Ectopic's going to be one, but the positive pregnancy test should really clue you in on that one. The other ones will be you should be sure to pick out PID. You should be sure to pick out ovarian torsion. These are, remember in the ED that our job is to rule out life, limb, site, and fertility threatening issues. So keep that in mind with every patient. Every patient on the boards is going to die, you know, or they're going to lose something important. So make sure that you clue in on that. For your ovarian torsion cases, it's going to be an abrupt, acute onset of pain. It's usually going to be accompanied by some kind of somatic complaint like vomiting or syncope or something that's generalized and not just related to the belly pain. So keep that in mind. If they say right lower quadrant pain and passed out, right lower quadrant pain and vomited, right lower quadrant pain and dropped to my knees. I mean, those are ones that in real life, in real clinical experience, I found those to be highly concerning for ovarian torsion.
A good case for that would be exactly what you're talking about, sudden onset, drop to my knees or syncope or whatever, unrelenting pain, negative ultrasound, what's the next best step? And the options will be something like laparoscopy, MRI, serial evaluations, discharge home. And what they're getting at is the sensitivity of ultrasound, which is not that great. I think it's sort of like 50%, isn't it?
It's poor. Yeah, the answer is going to be laparoscopy. They need a scope in the OR to take a look. And even the same with some of the pelvic pains they may talk about. They may hint at endometriosis with it. The same, the next step is laparoscopy.
Right.
And they can look and go. And any of these patients, even a PID or a tube ovarian abscess, laparoscopy is going to be the next step.
Very few of the answers for your questions are going to be outpatient things. They're not going to show up and go, oh, you have essential hypertension. Oh, you have essential tremor. You have hyperlipidemia. This is the emergency medicine board. So what are they getting at? Why are they making you take this test? They want to make sure that you know the emergent stuff. They want to make sure that you can pick up some of the subtleties of really dangerous diseases or things that are going to cause further harm, because that's why you've done all this extra residency training, is so you can pick these things up. So ovarian torsion, think history of prior cysts. History of ovarian cancer, history of previous instrumentation. These are things that should make you concerned for torsion. The other side would be PID. So pelvic inflammatory disease is almost always going to be some young adolescent or like 20-year-old that's going to come in, and they can't describe the PID shuffle on paper, so they'll probably just say
cervical motion tenderness.
But one of the things they may get at is the CDC really harps on this, and so does our college, is if you've got a sexually active young woman who is having pelvic pain in the absence of any other findings, it's not appendicitis, it's not a UTI, it's not anything else here, you should empirically treat for pelvic inflammatory disease, because they are high likelihood to be lost to follow-up and high likelihood to have tubal scarring and risk for ectopics and even getting septic from tube ovarian abscess.
And they might ask you what the antibiotics are.
They almost certainly
they will. They'll ask you.
So what are they?
Meropenem for everyone, right?
Vancomycin.
Vancomycin. Atazosin.
Meropenem.
Vancomycin.
Vancomycin. Gorilla kill them.
Godzilla. I always thought we should do the, remember the black and yellow song? We could do Vancomycin.
Franks and beans.
So it's going to be ceftriaxone, azithro for just typical STI.
But, or doxy.
Yeah, ceftriaxone doxy would be the big go-to if you've truly got PID, because you need that prolonged therapy for upper tract disease. Think of this as pilo. It's going to be upper tract, so you're going to need to treat it for longer versus just an STI that's just going to be at the mouth of the cervix. A UTI is just going to be in the bladder. You can clear those things quickly, but upper tract disease is going to need to be treated for a bit longer. So if they give you the option of ceftriaxone doxy, I would certainly go for that one.
Hey girl, are you a pulmonary embolism? Because you take my breath away.
So So moving on from gyne, can you guys think of any other gyne stuff that they would ask you? It's usually vaginal bleeding, pelvic pain.
Yeah, they'll ask pregnancy, third trimester. That'll be the next topic.
So that's OB. So we can go to OB stuff. Yeah.
Vaginosis, vaginitis, they may throw a quick question with that. With treatment, you know, whether you look for trich, whether you look for BV, whether you look for, you know, what's the treatment? They come in with itching.
Do you treat it in a pregnant patient?
Right. Do you treat it in a pregnant patient? Are they come in with dysuria, but they don't really have urinary tract symptoms, or maybe they have a dirty urine and dysuria, but they also have vaginal discharge and vaginal itching. You're going to treat not the UTI. You're going to treat them for a vaginitis.
One of the other things you can get is if they tell you a patient has something that looks like syphilis. Remember, syphilis and HIV tend to run together, so you should consider testing for HIV. Another thing that they may get you with is a woman who comes in with recurrent yeast infections. You should think about diabetes. New onset diabetes is actually one of the things you can see with recurrent yeast infections. So,
yeah. Herpes labialis will be on there.
Yeah. There'll be a huge picture of it. A giant picture of a chancre.
How do you know that? Did you donate the picture?
So OB stuff will be the next thing, and there's a lot of different stuff they could go with on OB. They'll do third trimester emergencies, they'll do OB trauma, they'll do maybe even OB radiology stuff.
They will ask preeclampsia.
Preeclampsia. And eclampsia, the whole spectrum, with help syndrome, pregnancy-induced hypertension, that'll all be on there.
So look for vital signs. If they won't get you with preeclampsia without telling you vital signs. So look for the vital signs that say that the blood pressure is 160 over 90. That's how often do you see 160 over 90 on one of your patients in the ED? But if they're pregnant, you got to start looking. And the things you would look for, you get a urine, you get liver enzymes, and you get a CBC to look for signs of help. So if there's protein in the urine, if there's elevated liver enzymes, and there's low platelets, you definitely think of help, preeclampsia, something in that spectrum. You throw in some seizures, you get eclampsia, and these are the things that they'll be screening for. The treatment for eclampsia, of course, is delivery. But before you can deliver them, you can do MAG, you can do a few other things.
I doubt they'll ask you the blood pressure regimen, because historically it's been hydralazine, but it's changed in the last 5 years to labetalol. So I think it's a bit of an unfair question. I doubt they'll ask it.
Right. Sure hope not. But the one of the things I always found scary is that you can have eclampsia up to 2 weeks after delivery.
2 months.
2 months after delivery, which is very difficult to get that baby back in there so that you can deliver it again. They tend not to like it, even when they're seizing. So let's say this pregnant woman walks into a bar, right, and she's got the worst headache of her life. What are you thinking about if you're on the boards?
Preeclampsia.
Preeclampsia, trauma. The outlier may be a cerebral dural sinus thrombosis. That's another thing that you think about. This is usually going to be like a really bad headache that's just not going away. If you've ruled out preeclampsia, this is one of the other things they can say. So if they've got normal blood pressure, then you could consider this one as well. So you both missed that question.
That's okay. Yeah. I'm not taking my in-service this year.
That's true. Yeah.
We should take it sometime.
It's been a while.
That's not a good idea.
I just wonder why his partner was drinking.
I didn't say she was drinking. I said she walked into a bar.
Second woman ducked.
So let's talk about trauma in pregnant women. So a pregnant woman comes in with trauma, and the question is, what is the next most appropriate step? Is it airway breathing circulation, or is it ultrasound the baby to make sure baby's okay?
If mom doesn't live, baby doesn't live.
Yes. Yeah. If mom dies, baby dies. Keep that in mind with all of these pregnant patients. If mom dies, baby dies. So do the assessment for mom that would be deemed appropriate. If mom comes in and she's had a day of a light cough and maybe a little bit of a runny nose, she probably doesn't need a chest x-ray. But if she's coming in with high fevers, hypoxia, and rails on her exam, you better believe she needs a chest x-ray. So if mom dies, baby dies.
Yeah, they might ask the whole mom comes in, getting CPR, what's the next step? It's a big midline incision for a
perimortem
C-section. They might ask,
what is the time frame and when do you need to start that? Look to start at 4 minutes, baby should be out by five.
Mm-hmm. Right. One of the other things they'll ask you is if a patient comes in, pregnant woman in a trauma, let's say an MVC, and she's got some evidence of hypotension, what's one of the first things you can do? And aside from fluids, you can also shift her a little bit to the left. So you have that supine hypotension syndrome where the fetus is actually just laying on the IVC. Nobody's getting blood return. So that's why pregnant women should not be laying on their back for prolonged periods of time. Really, not at all.
That's a good point. They might also ask the placental abruption question.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of the third trimester emergencies. So placental abruption, painful vaginal bleeding. Placenta previa, painless vaginal bleeding. So when you have a placental abruption, you will have some vaginal bleeding, or you might not. Sometimes all you have is pain. So if you have a negative ultrasound, that does not rule out your placental abruption. The only thing that rules it out is tachometry and a fetal heart rate monitor. So uterine irritability and fetal non-reassuring fetal heart tones are way more sensitive for an abruption than ultrasound or pretty much any other imaging modality. So this is similar to if you think of a heart that's got a little bit of a lot of dysrhythmias, lots of PVCs, runs of VT. That's a twitchy, irritable myocardium. You'd look at that strip and go, something ugly is happening on this heart. For the same way, OBs look at the fetal heart rate monitor and look for uterine contractions, and if they see signs of irritability, they say, this has got to be an abruption or something else that's dangerous. So if a pregnant woman comes in a car wreck, that's why we always monitor them for 4 hours with cardiotocographic monitoring.
Yeah, you'll admit any patient with a car accident or any trauma to the belly, they fell off a ladder, they all get admitted, they get toco, looking for D-cells, looking for signs of either abruption or fluid leak, impending delivery.
So here's another one. Pregnant lady walks into a bar and her water breaks.
Boil the water and get some towels.
So you just happen to be there, you said, I'm going to deliver this kid, and the first thing that comes out is a cord. What do you do?
Pee myself.
After that.
Poo myself.
After that.
Place it back inside her.
Oh, and then what?
You grab
put her head down.
You grab
and call 911.
You grab a glove, you find and elevate the presenting fetal part. So if it's a head, you push that head out of the way. If it's a foot, you push that foot out of the way, and then you really panic. So my wife was a labor nurse, and she had a patient that did that. She did triage at one of the hospitals around here, and a lady comes in, and she goes, yeah, I felt like this gush of fluid. And she goes to do the exam, and the cord is hanging out of the vagina. And she quickly reaches in, finds the presenting part, which thankfully was the head, and pushes it up, and she spent the next 45 minutes with her hand in the lady's cervix until they could section her and get her out because they had to call in the OB from home. So you can bet we still get Christmas cards from that lady because you get up close and personal with somebody doing that.
It's an important question, and they like to ask that question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're basically offloading the umbilical cord for as long as it need to till section. Those are nice.
So that's one of the big bad things. One of the other problems that can happen during pregnancy is shoulder dystocia. So we tend to have larger and larger babies. And if the shoulders get stuck, there's a couple things you can do. They don't recommend going immediately for the episiotomy. They don't recommend trying to jump up and down on the pubic ramus. They recommend the McRoberts maneuver, which is touch your knees to your elbows and push it back as far as you can to try to help open up the pelvis. We'll finish off previa by saying this is painless vaginal bleeding. This is a woman who is second or third trimester that comes in with vaginal bleeding. Now she's getting close to the age of viability. So we are first going to do a speculum exam and jam our fingers up to try to see if the os is open. Wrong.
Sounds wrong.
Yeah, we don't do that. Instead, what we're going to do is nothing. Don't do something. Stand there. Grab an ultrasound and try to verify where the placenta is. Because if you can verify it's a placenta previa, that's actually pretty good. Although some of these can bleed like crazy. So same as you would do for any other patient that's hemorrhaging, get your type and screen or type and cross if they're not looking well. get your OB on the phone and start to get this patient taken care of.
All of these are going to go to section. That's the answer for your next step, is getting them to section. None of these deliver.
Can you use a rhino rocket?
Afrin.
Afrin PV.
Afrin PV.
A rhino rocket laced with Afrin and cocaine.
Nice. First answer is always cocaine. Cocaine is cocaine. Never the right answer in pregnant women. Unless the question is, how do you get a pregnant woman to deliver? Do not do a speculum exam. But if you have a patient that is second or third trimester and you do need to do a speculum exam, it's different from the normal ones you do because you'll do it sterilely. You do a sterile spec. You try not to touch anything. Try not to mess with anything, and then you get them over to OB once you visualize the cervix and you know kind of where they're at. So Jared mentioned postpartum hemorrhage. So as the baby is out and everybody's relieved that the baby made it from point A to point B, you look back at point A and realize that point A is hemorrhaging to death. So things you can do, you've got Pitocin, you've got delivery of the placenta and making sure they don't have any other parts that are left behind, and vigorous uterine massage, which is basically dropping an elbow right in the pelvis and grinding that thing down until it actually gets back to normal shape.
And that'll be the first thing they'll ask. What's the next step? It would be vigorous uterine massage, deliver the placenta, continue to massage, and then start Pitocin. Mm-hmm. So you'd also get in the third trimester. You deliver the placenta. You're supposed to look at it. If you look at it and you see ruptured portions of it, doesn't look smooth, and like a nice, I don't know what a placenta looks like. Beef stew? I mean, it's like a jellyfish from the wrong planet.
It looks like something that's going to attach to the space shuttle and slowly take over our culture.
But it should be nice and smooth.
Maybe you could turn you into Venom from Spider-Man.
Yeah. Don't put it on your face or eat it. So if there's a chunk missing, then you have to think about a placenta accretia, and that there's maybe some placenta that eroded into the uterine wall, and these are patients that are also going to need to go to the operating room, either for a DNC or possible hysterectomy, depending on how severe it is.
You're not going to stick your hand up in there and try to scrape it out?
No, I wouldn't stick my hand up there and try to scrape it out. That just sounds wrong. Or a rep song.
Like a pomegranate.
It looks like pomegranate. It's a pomegranate. The inside of a pomegranate, exactly. But as smooth as the outside.
Oh, that's the creepiest rap song.
I think
I'm
the right answer, though, is stick your hand in there and try to
pull it out. An accretion and it gets into the wall, then you run into problems because you're screwed either way. You could put your hand up there and hold pressure.
A rhino rocket with cocaine.
Rhino rocket with cocaine.
I don't know how much of this to keep and how much to cut. It's going to be a 15-minute podcast.
You know, we really didn't want to do this year after last year.
But they may not want us to do it again.
People wanted it.
Hey, girl. Are you my appendix? Because I have this funny feeling in my stomach that makes me want to take you out immediately.
All right, Hemonc, so they're definitely going to ask you to differentiate between TTP, DIC, and what's the other one?
ITP.
ITP, yeah.
Jared, continue with a long diatribe about TTP and what we should do next.
No, you know what? I'm tired of you guys picking on me. I'm making everything harder than it needs to be.
What, one's a triad, one's a pentad. That's all you have to know. Yeah, one's satanic. Yeah.
So a patient comes in with a purpuric rash and a low platelet count, no other symptoms. Maybe they feel a little flu-like symptoms. That's going to be ITP, right? Patient comes in with renal failure, altered mental status, fever, thrombocytopenia, and a rash. They're going to have TTP. And then DIC is going to have bleeding from every orifice and whatnot. And that's a little page out of the Brian Drummond Pragmatic book without getting into the bleeding, coagulopathy, pathophysiology. That's all you need to know for those questions, right?
That's pretty much it.
I think the one other thing I would say is that if you have DIC, you could give some platelets. It's not going to do anything because they're going to chew them up and spit them out, but you could give some platelets. If you have ITP, you can give some platelets. It's not going to do anything because your body's going to chew them up and spit them out, but you can give platelets. If you have TTP, don't give platelets.
Yeah, what's the treatment for TTP?
Treatment for TTP is plasmapheresis.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you actually can get plasmapheresis in RED. I've gotten it in 4 hours. which I was shocked when I called the blood bank and said, I've got a patient with TTP. They were like, hello, hello. And they're standing at my shoulder going, where's the VASCath? How come you guys haven't started this yet? So they're all over this. So that's something that you can get pretty quickly if you know who to call and you're able to recognize it. I was fortunate enough to recognize it because the lady said, this reminds me of the last time I had TTP. And I said, stop, hold on. I'm trying to figure this out. You're rushing me, okay? Don't talk when I'm talking. And finally, I figured it out, and we were able to get her plasma.
It's going to look like septic shock. I mean, yeah. You're going to say, oh, this patient has septic shock. And it's not until somebody says, oh, they have TTP, that you're going to face palm and say, oh, it's TTP. Right. So they're going to give you a scenario, a question stem, that looks like septic shock.
And then you'll see the platelet count will be 26.
Right.
And you're like, oh, maybe it's not septic shock. Right. Maybe it's something else.
Right.
One of the other things they'll tell you is red cell disorders. So they may ask you some sickle cell issues. This is probably one of the areas where our residents have a hard time because I know both of the sickle cell patients in Tucson. They're very nice. So sickle cell issues, you want to be able to distinguish between the different crises that sickle cell patients can have. The pain crisis. They come in with pain that's similar to their previous painful crises. You treat their pain, you give them some fluids, and then plus or minus on the oxygen nowadays, that's something that we are now debating, the people that actually take care of lots of sickle cell patients. The acute chest syndrome, they come in with difficulty breathing or chest pain. You can't really tell looking at the chest x-ray, is this pneumonia, is this infarction, is this pneumofarction? So you treat it as both. They are at high risk for having encapsulated organism sepsis, so you make sure to treat them broadly.
However, most of the time their pneumonia is are atypicals. Mm-hmm.
We do love our ceftriaxone in the ED. We give it very freely. Don't be stingy with the ceftriaxone in the sickle cell patients. So if you've got a younger sickle cell patient that comes in with fever and they don't have any other source, have a low threshold for getting some blood cultures, getting a CBC, treating them empirically, and waiting to see if they grow out any kind of encapsulated organism from their blood culture.
And the treatment for the sick acute chest patients? Exchange transfusion.
That's more math than I would ever like to have to do in the ED.
No, you just dump some on the floor and put some back.
That's easy when they weigh 100 kilos. When they weigh 10 kilos, it's not so easy.
It's also treatment for disinfection.
That's disgusting.
All right, so the other crisis, they can have an aplastic crisis, which is where their normal hemoglobin of 8 is replaced by a hemoglobin of 4 or 5. So these are usually easier to pick up because they look pale. Some of the best places to look for pallor, look under the sclera, look on the palms. Everybody should have kind of the reddish lines on the palms as well as a lot of vasculature in the sclera. And if you don't have that, you should be concerned for anemia. So these are patients we should be checking a reticulocyte count on. The last one, which I don't know if they'll put on the boards, but is a very dangerous one. Dale Woolridge has seen this twice here in Tucson, which thank goodness Dale saw him and not me because I would have missed it, is splenic sequestration. So this is a younger sickle cell patient who still has a functional spleen where all of the red cells are just offloaded into the spleen. They've got all the red cells they need, but they're not circulating. They're not functional. So these kids look horrendously pale. They've got a giant palpable spleen, and they need blood now. They need emergency release blood now, and you need to squeeze that blood into them as fast as you can, or else they're going to die.
I doubt they'll ask questions on like genetic platelet disorders or bleeding disorders like von Willebrand's or Glanzmann's, but they probably will ask, or it would be fair game to ask questions on bleeding and liver disease, where the treatment would be vitamin K, bleeding and renal disease, where it'd be DDAVP, and there's likely to be questions on the anticoagulant use and what do you give. So if it's heparin overdose, patient comes in from dialysis, bleeding to death, it's protamine. If they come in and they're on Warfront, how do you reverse that? It's going to be FFP. I doubt they're going to ask questions on like PCC because it's still fairly new.
They won't have River Rocks Band or Xeralto. They'll stay away from those.
The answer to that is dialysis.
Oh, I thought it was just they're going to die.
No, it's dialysis.
Dialysis.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Dialysis.
You can dial like 30% of River Rocks Band off.
That's good to know. I'm glad we can do something for it. So that's great. So if my patient comes in overdosed on rivaroxaban and they're bleeding, all I have to do is put a VASCath in them?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah, great. Yeah.
Sounds, just one stick. It's not an internal.
Sounds like a delightful day. All right. And then
it's not going to get better.
White cell disorders, usually we like to call infection or inflammation. But leukemias are something to keep an eye out for. So you've got your chronic leukemias, your CLL, which the patient's probably going to be fairly asymptomatic, versus your ALL, where they are going to look like stink.
Coming back up, and we're not done, right? We got the hemophilias.
Okay.
They might ask about the hemophilias.
Back up.
These are questions, right?
Yeah. Go ahead. So this is more of a question for you because it's more of a Pete World question, but they might ask a question on somebody comes in with hemophilia A or hemophilia B, and they might say, oh, their activity, their factor 8 or factor 9 activity is 0% or 5% or something, and they'll ask you how much of their factor do you need to give, and the answer would be.
So the first thing is, depending on the injury, you always assume they're at 0%. So if it's a head injury, you always assume they have never seen factor in their life, and you replace them 100%. So with factor 8, you get 2% activity for every unit per kilogram you give, which means you give 50 units per kilogram to restore somebody to 100% factor activity. If they're Christmas disease or hemophilia B, then you give you get 1% back for every unit per kilogram for factor, which means you give 100 units per kilo of factor 9 in order to replace for hemophilia B.
They may ask you, not even necessarily the exact replacement, but they may say, what blood product would you use next? You know, so they may say cryo, FFP, which would be better for this disease? You don't have DDAVP available. Would you give them platelets or not? Would you give them cryo, yes or no? And so they may ask you that instead of like the exact specific recombinant factor.
I'd give cryo.
Right. Yeah.
And give cryo.
Cryo.
All right. Good. We're on agreement.
I don't think
we'd all pass or miss the question.
I don't think they'll ask questions on acquired hemolytic anemias or any of those other things. Do you?
No. They may show you a slide. That's. I'm trying to think if they showed you slides, but they may show you a schistocyte. They may show you a sickled cell on a slide.
They may show you malaria.
They may show you basophilic stippling for lead poisoning. That one drives me crazy.
But they're
look
not gonna,
that one up.
They're not going to show. They're not going to ask you like cold agglutinemia.
No,
of those things. It's going to be malaria is a very good one.
Right. They're not going to go over like different variant anemias with these different sizes of the red cells on.
Those high power medicine questions.
Right. That's not
total iron binding capacity. I wouldn't bother with that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But the malaria is a good question. And what do you think they'll ask? They'll ask the treatment. They might ask which of the four strains of malaria or which of the four types.
Right. Sometimes they do ask preventative questions. Patient's going to be traveling to a malaria endemic area. Would you start them on medicine? Sometimes they've asked, do you have, you know, which of these would be a prophylactic? Or they were on prophylactic meds, they still went to malaria infested country. Do you still treat them or look for malaria? And the answer is yes.
Hey girl, do you have Ebola? Because you look hot and dangerous.
So that's all the heme stuff. For onc stuff, febrile neutropenia is something they will absolutely ask you about. Febrile neutropenia first has to be confirmed by neutropenia. Not everybody that has cancer is neutropenic, and not everybody with cancer needs to be treated as if they're neutropenic just because they had a fever. So you can look for other sources, but if you have neutropenia, which is an absolute neutrophil count less than 500, you should be treated empirically. So usually if you have indwelling lines or anything that would make you concerned for skin flora, you should treat with some something like vancomycin, and everything else should be covered with some kind of anti-pseudomonal gram-negative, something like a cefepime or a piptazo, something to that degree, in order to cover for all the big bad bugs that can cause febrile neutropenia.
Yeah, they will ask tumor lysis syndrome, or they might ask tumor lysis syndrome. And that one would be fairly obvious. I wouldn't even worry about determining is the calcium up or down, is the potassium up or down. It's going to be a patient with AML who comes in with wild electrolyte abnormalities. Brian Drummond, pragmatic approach.
Oh, yeah. Recent chemo. Patient sick. Treat them. Tumor lysis. That's the only cancer diagnosis I think you need, tumor lysis.
Yeah, I would probably agree with that. Yeah.
So everything else is irrelevant.
Let's say this with real quick with hem-onc. Let's say hem-onc patient, history of breast cancer, currently undergoing chemotherapy, comes in complaining of shortness of breath. The two most deadly things that you have to rule out in a shortness of breath patient, or let's ask it this way, what is the next most appropriate step? What would you want on a patient who is short of breath that has breast cancer undergoing treatment?
Ultrasound at bedside to the heart.
Exactly.
Looking for?
Tamponade and
fusion.
That's number one, and then the RV for a PE.
There you go. Right. So those are two big things. Look for JVD, and they'll say, oh, this is a patient with lymphoma or breast cancer, especially something that is near the chest. And they'll say, this patient has gradual onset shortness of breath. Think of pericardial effusion that has now led to tamponade, which you can see with the ultrasound. And you can also look for RV dysfunction that would make you concerned for a PE in this hypercoagulable patient.
Yeah, the solid tumors, they'll ask things like that. They'll ask pericardial effusion, they'll ask PE. The hematologic malignancies, they'll ask tumor lysis syndrome, SVC syndrome, treatment for that, steroids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe a diuretic here and there.
Just here and there, though. A smattering of
hypercalcemia. They might ask about hypercalcemia, especially.
And management.
Yeah. So what do you think? If I was going to ask a question on hypercalcemia and malignancy, I'd give a calcium north of 15. And
yes.
I'd ask what to do with it, and you would say fluids.
Fluids. And maybe Lasix to follow.
Maybe Lasix. They might give you pomidronate, but that might be the right answer in the real world, but it only acts like a week later or something. It's not going to act right away.
It wouldn't be the next most appropriate step.
Correct.
If they're asking.
Maybe fluids, Lasix.
Yeah, so high dose IV hydration followed by Lasix, because loops lose calcium. Remember, keep that in mind.
They might ask adrenal insufficiency, but I doubt it.
I'm going to clip that. That was... No.
Yeah, you can
have an accent.
They might ask an Addison's.
They would.
Patient comes in with tan skin and a metabolic acidosis.
Relative adrenal insufficiency. You get a low sodium and a high K, and someone with belly pain and hypotension, and you're treating them, and then all of a sudden, oh, nothing's getting better. What would be your next step? Maybe treat with hydrocortisone, or at least do a stim test or DEX, one of those answers.
That's one of the other things they may ask you is patient comes in with fatigue, malaise. You find they've got a sodium of 112 and they've got a spot on their chest x-ray. What does this patient have?
That's a very good perineoplastic syndrome.
Yeah, so think about the perineoplastic stuff because that's going to actually change your management. This isn't somebody we'll just correct their sodium. It's no, you got a tumor issue that needs to be taken care of sooner rather than later.
SIADH is going to be the one that they ask. They could ask the parathyroid hormone related protein, but that's kind of a dirty question.
That's a dirty question.
They might. It's not outside the realm of possibility that they give you a patient that comes in with a hematocrit of north of 60 and ask you what to do, and it's going to be bloodletting and fluids.
I love any question when the answer is bloodletting.
Yes. So far, a lot of the answers to these are either steroids or put some blood on the floor.
Uh-huh. That's all neuro, too.
Exactly.
Bloodletting.
Yeah.
They might ask something, brain tumor, spinal cord compression that needs emergent radiation.
Cord compression, yeah.
Cryptorchidism. What's that like, Jared?
God.
His response was, "How is your ovarian torsion, Aaron?"
Enjoying it thoroughly.
Blood transfusions and complications.
I doubt they're going to ask. They could ask trolley, maybe.
Allergic reaction, a fever. You start transfusing someone, they get a fever. What do you do next? Or like a massive allergic reaction or massive hemolysis. They may ask those. What is the next step? It's usually stop the blood.
Right. Stop the transfusion.
Stop the transfusion.
Maybe Tylenol and some antibiotics if you think it's an infected bag of blood or something.
Send the blood back to the blood bank.
Trolley will be something like massive pulmonary edema within 6 hours of the transfusion. And it's usually not PRBCs, it's usually FFP or platelets.
And trolley, for those of you that don't know the acronym, it's transfusion-related acute lung injury. So they're going to get pulmonary edema, they're going to have hypoxia, difficulty breathing.
Within
6 hours. Yeah, and it's mostly associated with platelets.
Girl, my feelings for you are like C. diff. I can't hold them in any longer.
To kill this, we're going to talk about some environmental stuff. This isn't necessarily going to be tox. This is going to be stuff that, surprisingly, we don't get a lot of in Tucson. So the marine envenomations and the altitude sickness and something maybe you do see a little more, which is exposure stuff. So for the easy things that hopefully all of you will get because you've been in Tucson in the summertime, some of you might have actually had this, heat exhaustion versus heat stroke. So you need to have a core temperature to be able to get heat exhaustion and heat stroke. You really need a good core temperature, which can either be PO or PR. Once you've got that elevated temperature, first you make sure it's not sepsis. Done that one accidentally a couple times. And then second, you start to hydrate them, you start to cool them. I'll tell you that any temperature greater than about 106, 107, really difficult to manifest on your own. This is induced by outside thermal characteristics. I've seen temps of 105 that patients were able to manage intrinsically. Their bodies could do that. Much higher than that, I start thinking of some kind of exogenous heat source.
If they ask a question with a temp of 106, 107, 108, I would bet money that that's going to be a malignant hyperthermia question.
Yes.
And not a heat stroke question. The heat stroke question is going to be a marathon runner with a temp of 104.
Right. Yeah, the super high ones, they're going to look for some anesthetic agent, right, or some antipsychotic or something that they've been exposed to. But yeah, there's going to be some exposure for a heat element of, I was in the desert, I was running, I was doing something that generated that heat or exposed, right, to that heat.
They're probably not going to ask you to differentiate between heat cramps and heat exhaustion, but they might ask you to differentiate between heat exhaustion and heat stroke, and that's ultimately
yeah.
So there's the big difference there.
I would lump the marathon runner comes in with a sodium of 108 in there too as a potential environmental question that they would ask.
Yeah. So keep in mind, sepsis is still far more common, but if they give you the right scenario, think heat exhaustion, heat stroke. On the other end, there you can actually get too cold. For those of you that are in Tucson in January, you actually can get too cold, and this is hypothermia. So you've got hypothermia, which is going to be a temp less than, I think, 36.0 is going to be technically hypothermia, or 35.0.
35.
All right. So hypothermia is going to be a temperature less than 35.0, and you're going to start to actively warm this patient. So recognizing hypothermia, it involves putting your hand on the patient's skin, and then the treatment of it is warming, whether it's through external means, a bear hugger, warm blankets, or internal means such as IV fluids that are warmed, or even sometimes you go even further with organ lavage, like the bladder
next,
lavage.
The next best step is going to be warm fluids because they all have cold diuresis. They might ask you a cold after drop question where you start to rewarm them and all the cold blood from their extremities comes back centrally and their temperature drops.
Yeah, they're not going to ask you to do a thoracotomy or chest tubes, right, with rewarming. They're going to start with warm IV fluids, bear hugger, maybe some gastric or bladder lavage, but they're not going to get any farther than that.
For the heat one, they might ask you what's the best way to cool them down.
Yes.
And it's going to be evaporative.
Misting with fans. with tepid water, and then when they start to get around 100 to 101, you're going to stop cooling them and dry them off.
I miss this one every time. Will you guys help me tell the difference between cold nip and frostbite? Or frost nip and frostbite.
See, I think frost nip is viable, frostbite is non-viable.
Right. Okay. It caused actual freezing of the cells as opposed to chilling of the cells in a sense.
I grew up in Phoenix, so I've never had been exposed to either. At least I thought I had, but it turns out I haven't.
The other thing they like to do with, they may show EKG findings with hypothermia, so that's a common thing that they'll throw on with an Osborne wave.
Oh, that's good. They might get that.
They just show an EKG, and they may not say, oh, this patient comes in, they're kind of altered, and here was their EKG findings. What would be the next most appropriate step? Check a rectal temperature.
They're not going to ask you about beryllium for a refractory.
Jeez.
No.
Dude, I think I have a headache now. We're clearly nearing the end of what we can conceivably do for this. So
altitude stuff, they're going to ask you HAPE and HACE and the treatment for those. Both of them are going to be descent.
Descent.
So high altitude pulmonary edema and high altitude cerebral edema.
There we go.
So when you're hiking and you have somebody that's ascended, especially quickly, and they're showing signs of altered mental status versus signs of difficulty breathing, you get them down to a normal atmosphere, or at least one that they were more comfortable at, and that should help with most of it. When that doesn't work, then what do you go?
They'll also Dex, and then they're going to ask you for
Acetazolamide.
Those would be the other two answers with these.
Okay. Let's go the other way. Let's say you've gone too low. You're scuba diving, and you've gone down, and you decided you wanted to come up way too fast, and you start vomiting up frothy sputum.
Descend.
Yeah, descend them farther. You actually puncture both lungs and put them in the bottom of the sea. They actually do better there because they're cool, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's the coolest treatment for anything I've ever heard. Stab him in the chest twice and
Davy tie
it's away. Davy Jones locker.
Yeah. They got shorter. I'm not sure why I'm shorter.
All this pressure.
Now, for any of these, you would. This is all going to be hyperbarics. You got to dive them in hyperbarics. You put them down, and so it's kind of like it, but it's different. You put them in the hyperbarics, and you slowly bring them back up.
Pushes the nitrogen back into solution.
Exactly.
So descend.
Right, and this can be even. They can get into this differently. They can say maybe a diving injury, and they come up and now they're altered, or they're having just bad abdominal pain, or they're having joint pain. They can flare any of the decompression injuries into this as different presentations. All of it's going to be hyperbarics.
Yeah, they might ask you a stroke. If a patient has a stroke.
Right.
Don't go diving.
Don't go diving.
Yeah.
Don't drink and dive.
So while you're diving, let's say that you've made a successful dive, and as you get out of the little bay that you're in, you step on something spiky or something slimy, and you've got something that stung you. So marine envenomations, one of the first things that comes up, I think, is do you sew it? Generally, the answer is no.
I thought it was whether you peed on it or not.
Yourself or
no? You have your friend pee on it. You don't put your own urine on it.
Yeah. That's gross.
So I think the peeing on your foot has been debunked. Although if you can convince someone that you need to pee on their foot, I still think that's hilarious. It didn't work. Let me try it again. Let me get a couple other people to pee on you.
Shrinkage, Jerry.
You have to get that. You have to get the nematocysts off without them rupturing. So
right.
Warm water. Vinegar, shave them off with shaving cream.
Yeah. The first thing, if someone comes out, will be just they can use salt water right there because you're already exposed to it, and they try to wash them off. Again, don't pop them. Try to get these off as easy as possible. And don't touch it with your bare hands either because that transfers it.
You know, one thing they could ask you is drowning or near drowning. And the way they would ask it is, which is worse, fresh water or salt water?
it's salt water because it's more osmotic.
Yeah, that's one of those like things that they've talked about for a long time that hasn't really borne out in the literature. So they, which means that they may still ask you about it. But you're supposed to get more electrolyte shifts if you drown in salt water. I think that's only true if you drown in the Dead Sea.
I don't think it's an electrolyte shift problem. I think it's a capillary leak problem because it's so osmotic.
Yeah. If you drown in the Dead Sea, first of all, you shouldn't be able to drown in the Dead Sea because people float. But it's got to be a pretty good osmotic shift in order to cause that. So.
Burns, they're going to ask you to calculate the Parkland formula.
Yeah. So, for your memory, the Parkland formula is going to be 4 times the body surface area percentage affected times the weight in kilograms, and then you're going to add on to that maintenance IV fluids.
Yeah, they could ask you about transfer to a major burn center, what the criteria for that are, and it's what circumferential around a joint, dominant hand, face, or what's the, I can't remember the total body surface area.
40%. 40%. Usually they go 40%.
Yeah, you also do genitals over joints, anything that's going to lead to a contracture.
All peds and all elderly usually go.
So this is, and again, this is what the exam tells you versus, you know, what we actually do, depending on where you work. If you have burn surgeons there, you can do different things. But these are kind of globally recognized issues. And let's say that somebody comes in, they were in a house fire, and they come in and respiratory distress, kind of sluggish, not breathing that much. You take a look in the at the airway, there is no soot whatsoever in the airway. And yet they're hypoxic and not doing very well. What is their actual toxicity?
Cyanide.
So keep in mind, they've been inhaling all this stuff from the burning house. They may actually have cyanide toxicity, and this is not an airway burn. They haven't inhaled a bunch of soot. So keep that in mind with people that were stuck in house fires. I have a theory that there are only 3 people that ever come in with burns to the face, and it's generally smoking on oxygen, weekend warrior lighting the barbecue, and meth lab. So if you have been
furnace pilot light,
if you have been burnt on the face and you were not one of those 3, I'm very, very sorry if I've offended you.
Chemical burns, hydrochloric acid, hydrofluoric acid, treatment for that.
Calcium topically, calcium gluconate injections, calcium gluconate in the IV with a reversed IV towards that area.
Alkali burns are liquefactive necrosis. Acid burns are...
Caseative, yeah. Necrosis. The other C stuff they may ask you is wound infections from freshwater, saltwater. Think Vibrio and treat with Cipro as opposed to your regular Keflex. The other ones that sometimes they'll throw on are Ciguatera or Scromboid. Poisoning to look like allergic reactions or nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, treated similar with antihistamines and steroids.
Which one's got the hot cold reversal? Ciguatera,
because it sounds really cool.
Yeah.
Scromboid just sounds like something that you got eating a bad lobster roll. Okay, patient comes in found down in a field, unresponsive, and they've got a dendritic pattern on their forearm of big red streaks. What happened to this poor gentleman?
Lightning injury.
Yeah.
How do the clothes blow off?
That sounds like a loaded question.
No. How did they lose their shoes blow off 30 feet? The clothes blow off. How's it happen?
I don't know.
Well, unlike a regular electrical current that goes through your body, the lightning current goes over the surface of your body and it heats up all the grease and oils and everything that you have into steam, and that steam creates pressure and blows everything off.
That's disturbing.
Wow. The other thing they can ask with those are seizures or posterior shoulder dislocation, so they may have that with any electrical or high voltage injury.
And not on your test, but definitely useful living in Tucson, what do you do if you get too much capsaicin on your skin if you've been making jalapeno poppers or making salsa or something like that and everything is on fire?
Rub your eyes?
No, rub your friend's eyes. Milk. So you actually douse your hands or your affected area in milk and neutralize it pretty well. We had a kid come into the ED who was, I have jalapeno popperitis and I've been making jalapeno poppers. My hands are on fire and I'm breathing heavy and I can't do anything. So I grabbed Chris Edwards, our excellent neighborhood ED pharmacist. I said, Chris, what do we do for this? He goes, milk. I'm like, really? He goes, yep. And he goes into the fridge, of which our pharmacists also have access to, pours a whole bunch of milk, and within about 2 minutes, the kid goes, yeah, I feel totally better. Discharged home with topical moo. So
nice.
I have a good milk story. Do you have time for a story?
Quick
story?
I always have time for a milk story.
Okay, so when I was in medical school, my college friends and I were all together for a weekend, and we had to go to a wedding. And this was right after the Family Guy episode came on where they all drank Ipecac. Yeah. So we decided...
Was this the gallon milk challenge?
No. We had done that the week before. We decided we were going to do the Ipecac challenge. So we go around to four different pharmacies, get four bottles of Ipecac, and we had this big breakfast, and we said, all right, we're going to do this. And so we all take it, and like 18 minutes later, everyone's just retching, just puking their brains out. And we all had a good laugh and thought it was going to be like one time puke, chest bump, and move on to the wedding, right? But no, it like 10 minutes later, wave two comes. This goes on and on and on. So I'm a medical student, right? I know what to do. So I get on Google, like every good doctor, and try to figure out what is the antidote to Ipecac. And what do they say? Milk. So I'm drinking milk, puke that up. Eat ice cream, puke that up. 4.5 hours goes by.
That's horrible. That's disgusting.
That's really disgusting. Yeah.
Are you going to do it again?
No, absolutely not.
You going to tell your kid about it?
Definitely.
I love you more than Ivy Dilaudid, Phenergan, and Benadryl, all pushed in the same syringe.
We digress quite a bit. Thank you guys for joining us on what has been a very, very long episode of AZMcast. It's probably less long for you because we've edited it down to about 5 minutes of podcast of internet appropriate non-litigious recording. So hopefully this helps you guys with just the very bottom of the barrel of what you may need to cram into your brain before the end service. Please don't spend too much time listening to this podcast. Do actual studying. Look at EKGs. Look at some of the pictures that are in case books. Do some of the peer practice questions. Just get ready for it and whatever you think you need. If you find, man, I am really, really good at the signs and symptoms stuff, but I really struggle with cardiac stuff, well, then spend more time on cardiac. But you guys are fantastic residents, you're fantastic doctors, and you're going to do great on the exam. So good luck to everybody.
Yeah, good luck on your tests. Thanks to all the non-residents for bearing with us. Thanks for joining us, Brian.
This is nice. I feel very homely in here. It's like I'm closer to you guys than I've ever been before.
Well, that's because next month we'll go back to you slamming us after we're done recording.
Hey, you know, if you guys tee it up, I'll swing at it.
Is your name adenosine? 'Cause you make my heart stop.